Listener supported. WNYC Studios.
Hey, it's Latif from Radiolab. Our goal with each episode is to make you think, how did I live this long and not know that? Radiolab. Adventures on the edge of what we think we know. Listen wherever you get podcasts.
From WNYC New York Public Radio, this is The Brian Lehrer Show. I'm Brian Lehrer. This is just one segment of our show, but every interview is available on demand at WNYC.org. This on-demand service is made possible by WNYC and its listeners, so please help support this free service by becoming a member at WNYC.org.
WNYC On Demand is supported by Open from American Express, presenting the interactive webcast event, Making a Name for Yourself. Kate and Andy Spade and Bobby Brown discuss their leap from business to brand, created by Open from American Express. Registration at openforumonline.com.
Brian Lehrer on WNYC, and they're back. The tents are up in Bryant Park. And that means the fashion world is abuzz with which celebrities are wearing what and how to score tickets to the hot shows. The lions outside the New York Public Library, for their part, ignore the hullabaloo in their backyard. But inside the library, the attitude seems to be, if you can't beat them, join them. There's a new exhibit on display there called A Rakish History of Menswear that takes a look at men's fashions from the Greek warriors through Sean Combs. Joining me now to talk about the exhibition is its curator, Paula Baxter. And for more insight into men and fashion, we're also joined by GQ magazine style guy, Glenn O'Brien. Welcome to WNYC, Paula and Glenn.
Hi.
Thank you very much.
Paula, the show is titled A Rakish History of Menswear. What is meant by rake?
Rake really refers to the fact that it's rebels of fashion who caused some of the great innovations in clothing. And men were the ones that led fashion, in particular young men. Rakes, they just happened to be rakes along at the same time. It's intriguing because it sounds a little subversive and we're used to thinking of fashion as being so codified, but it really has another side to it.
And in the exhibit, you point to two big influences on menswear over history, the military and the, quote, dandy. So let's start with the role of the dandy. Beau Brummel, was he the first?
Oh, no. Julius Caesar was a dandy, too.
Dandies
go right back to antiquity. Very important. They're often leaders. They were men in the news of their time. But Beau Brummel was very special because he was the inventor of the modern men's suit uniform. He set the way for the white shirt, the dark jacket, and the buff or same-colored pants that men wear today. And he did it in an interesting setting of early 19th century England.
What did you mean by Julius Caesar was a dandy?
He was known for being a flashy dresser and a bit of a rake.
Glenn, does this all sound right to you?
Oh, yeah, absolutely. I mean, it's funny because people often use Beau Brummel as an example of someone who was flashy, but in fact, he sort of brought in the conservative look. He paid a lot of attention to his clothes, but he was not a peacock in the old sense.
When did he live exactly?
1788 to 1830-something. I slipped for a minute.
1840, I think.
Yeah.
So what was conservative, Glenn, in that era?
He wore dark jackets and so on. I don't know if anybody saw the Libertine, the Johnny Depp
film. Oh, I sure did.
About Lord Rochester, but that's a great men's clothes picture, and that takes place in the 17th century, at the time of the Restoration, and that was a sort of peak of foppery and color and velvet and luxury, and Brummel kind of was a transitional figure toward Paula said, he kind of invented the modern idea of the suit.
We can take your phone calls, listeners, for the style guy, Glenn O'Brien from GQ, and for Paula Baxter, the curator of a new exhibit at the New York Public Library, giving it all establishment legitimacy, called A Rakish History of Menswear. Men, what's your biggest fashion influence? Do you feel constricted by your fashion choices, or do you like wearing sort of a uniform to work, whether you work for the sanitation department or a Wall Street investment firm? Call us at 212-433-WNYC, 433-9692. Paula, the military's role. Now, there's no equivalent influence in women's fashion, is there?
Probably not. Men from the beginning were often, the military men often led the fashion, particularly you even have precedents back to the medieval era when you had mercenary soldiers. One of the ways that they sold their services and advertised their virility was by wearing rather extravagant outfits that showed their big chests and their various forms of prowess. Military men soldiers went to the Crusades and came back with some interesting new fabrics and styles and ideas. You even have men like the Duke of Wellington with his Wellingtons, who was known as the Beau. You've got quite a historical precedent, and even Beau Brummel himself briefly served in the English Army, and of course a good regiment, the Hussars, where he looked very good in a coat.
Glenn, you want to talk about military influence on men's style?
Well, I think that that's, you know, it's always been one of the big recruiting tools of the military, was that you got to wear a flashy uniform, and you know, there are a lot of instances of very, you know, sharp clothes that you know, perform that function. I mean, all you have to do is look at the United States Marines to get it, what it's all about. And I think it's something that continues today. And, you know, we've seen, you know, the camouflage has been, you know, made into wedding dresses and, you know, I mean, just about everything you can think of. So It's always a factor, I believe.
Now, you know what's interesting? I invited listener calls. We have a little trickle of men calling in, but not many. So, guys, come on. Don't pretend you don't care. 212-433-WNYC, 433-9692. What's your biggest fashion influence? Do you feel constricted by your fashion choices? Do you like wearing sort of a uniform to work, whether you work for the sanitation department or on Wall Street? 212-433-WNYC, 433-9692, and Malcolm in Manhattan. You're on WNYC. Hi, Malcolm.
Oh, hi. I used to be in my youth in the clothing trade and the retail end, but now I'm an aging, shall we say, recording engineer in New York.
Mm-hmm.
And I can dress any way I like, but my big question is, why on earth has the clothing for men not changed at all much in the last 80 or 90 years? I mean, we have slightly wider lapels, narrow lapels, longer, shorter jackets, you know, floppy trousers, tight trousers. But beyond that, it's the same darn thing.
Glenn O'Brien, do you see it that way?
Well, aren't we lucky that, you know, our wardrobes aren't made obsolete every year? I mean,
we're talking about 80 years, not every year.
Well, but isn't that a nice sign of cultural stability? I mean, what would you like to be wearing, togas? I mean, I think that, you know, the suit is
boring.
A terrific book called Sex and Suits, and I can't remember the name of the author.
Ann Hollander's.
But it was about how the suit was the ultimate modernist concept.
I do remember, for example, obviously with my accent of guitar, I come from the UK, although I've been here for nearly 40 years and I'm an American now. But I do remember that, I think it was in the 50s, we did have a little flutter with the Teddy Boy kind of suit, which was the, you know, high collar and all that kind of thing.
I rather
liked that. I had one mm-hmm. myself because it did give at least a bit of...
Well, if you're a recording engineer, you should put it back on because you probably look good that way. I think there's room to maneuver within the... you know, the confines of what men are supposed to wear. And right now we're seeing a kind of return to the clothes of the 1960s with the slimmer lapels and slimmer ties and flat front trousers. You know, so, I mean, if you took today's suit and you put it next to the suit that maybe Pat Riley was wearing when he was coaching the Knicks in the 1990s, there's a huge difference. These big, giant shoulder pads and these big blousy pants with pleats. I mean, it's things change. It's just it's more in the details, but there's definitely a big change.
Malcolm, thanks a lot. Now, Paula, you know, Eric Wilson wrote a piece in the Times during the heat wave about the attempt to start a trend of shorts with a jacket, in the office, at least to get by those steamy days. But it didn't go over very well. And, you know, men seem so disadvantaged, at least in hot weather, by the current uniform, while women can show up in the office in, you know, in anything, it seems, although women are very disadvantaged in many other ways.
Well, there were attempts at dress reform, even back to the 1930s. There were dress reform where they actually did try to get a suit and shorts, and the only thing that worked was shorts, but not for formal wear. Men do love their suits. Going back to what Malcolm was saying, I do want to just say that in 1930, a man named Feigl came up with a theory called the Great Masculine Renunciation, which was the reason why men got into these suits and never wanted to budge. It's still a pretty good theory, and it's holding true, and there is something about a suit I'm firmly convinced it's a new suit of armor, and that men stayed in their suits and they stayed in their neckties during that heat wave because they had an image to project, and it was more important than being cool.
Steve? No, I'm sorry. It's Ruben in Manhattan. Ruben, you're on WNYC. No, he's not. I have to press this button. Hi, Ruben.
Hi. Hello?
Hi. Let's see. Where is that phone ringing?
It's in my house, and there's nothing I can do about it.
Okay, Ruben, go ahead. We're just going to turn you down for a minute, Glenn. Hi, Ruben.
Yes, I'm one of these kind of guys who is not fashionable at all, so the way I dress is basically buy stuff that's never in style because it never goes out. So, like, L.L. Bean is my main clothing supplier. But I wanted to point out that the trench coats that everybody wears, men and women alike, I believe was based on a military officer's coat. That was basically it. And I hope for a return to the 30s so everybody gets to wear nice hats.
Thank you very much. We'll go right on to Kent in Manhattan. You're on WNYC. Hi, Kent.
Hi, yes. The trench coat was designed for World War I, for the trenches, as was the watch band, you know, instead of a pocket watch, because you had all that, those heavy anti-gas equipment, just to answer his last thing about the trench coat.
Right. Okay.
I was just going to observe, as a costume designer, I've always sort of observing people, what they wear. And I was in the military 8 years, and I noticed how even soldiers who were supposed to be very much, you know, by exact regulations wearing things, do make modifications. Like, something supposed to be used for a sling when you break your arm, and they wear those around their necks as kerchiefs or around their heads as do-rags. Even in what you would think is a highly regulated, mm-hmm. non-fashionable thing, people still find their ways. And then I saw civilians starting to copy this, and you know, for with no functionality intended to they'd see pictures of this, and then they would wear things like that themselves.
Paula Baxter?
Absolutely. There's lots of precedents for this. Going back, also I wanted to mention the thing about Teddy Boys. The Teddy Boys have the Zoot Suits, the American Zoot Suits, which were premiered by young men of color in America and were part of the L.A. Zoot Suit riots in 1943. There's a lot of historical precedents for how we ended up. But that really flaring, big-sized Zoot Suit on someone marvelous like Cab Calloway had a huge influence, and it crossed the Atlantic and became the Teddy Boy outfit. So everything's interconnected.
A lot of the great generals have been fashion influences, like Eisenhower with the Eisenhower jacket, General Patton with those big blousy cavalry pants. General MacArthur designed his own uniforms, I think, with more scrambled eggs on the brim of his hat than anybody had ever seen before. So I think, you know, that's an old tradition.
All right. And Ken, thank you for your call. This is 93.9 and AM 820 WNYC. My guests, Paula Baxter, curator of a new exhibition at the New York Public Library main branch called A Rakish History of Menswear, that takes a look at men's fashions from the Greek warriors through Sean Combs. And we're getting additional insight on this from GQ Magazine style guy, Glenn O'Brien. Glenn, you said a minute ago that the suit was the ultimate expression of modernism. What did you mean by that?
Well, sort of less is more philosophy that, you know, that we saw with the Bauhaus and the you know, in architecture, just this kind of, I guess, yeah, sort of renunciation of ostentation and detail, and, you know, keeping things simple.
Richard on Long Island, you're on WNYC. Hi, Richard.
Oh, thank you for taking my call. I wanted to address something to Glenn O'Brien. I just wanted to start by telling you that my son and I read your column every month in GQ. We read it out loud to each other. I find it very entertaining.
Oh, thank you.
Proud to say that I'm in agreement with you almost 100% of the time. And here's my my question. What happened to, or where has the Nehru look, or that look for that the Chinese political elite wear with the jacket and slacks, but without the shirt and tie, or for that matter, the banded collar shirt? I'm wondering how come, because I happen to like that kind of look, and it feels good and it looks good without the whole shirt and tie business, but you could still look reasonably together and reasonably formal. How come that's never really taken off or caught on? It comes back around, but then it fades out.
Or some American version of it, if you can detach it, I guess, from the political overtones of Nehru or the Chinese.
I think it's funny, there are political issues involved in fashion. If you look at the Iranians, for example, they all wear business suits and none of them wear ties because that's considered to be a decadent bourgeois Western symbol.
Okay.
If you look at the president of Iran, you'll never see him wearing a tie. And I think the Nehru is actually kind of a good look for today, and I think it's sort of coming back. I noticed that one of the four commentators on the ESPN Monday Night Football last night had on a Nehru jacket, and I was saying, yeah, I just bought one.
And there is at least one other person who actually has already come up in this program, and that is City Councilman Charles Barron. So just to put that on the record.
He's wearing a Nehru suit?
I think it's a Nehru suit or something like the look that the caller was describing. So Paula Baxter, what would you say, having put together this exhibit, that the big influences in men's fashion are today? Are there dominant ones that you can list?
For today, I think it is restraint. I'm wondering if the men's casual wear, and Glenn would know this better, if that's going to be the new ostentation, because what we do know historically is that men's fashions have moved from restraint to ostentation, and now they're back in restraint for a really long period of time. But there's also been this huge development of urban streetwear and casual men's clothes, and I'm just wondering if down the road we're going to see our little expressions of ostentation come up there. Men do want to dress alike, and they do want to look alike, and some men are very proud of following fashion, and some men don't want anything to do with it, and we do show that in the exhibition. Men are always going to be a bit diffident about this topic.
By the way, we have a nice debate going in the control room right now about whether Charles Barron wears a Nehru jacket or a Mao jacket, so just to keep you apprised of what's going on behind the scenes. Glenn, big influences today?
I think what Paula said is interesting, because I think that it used to all be about, conspicuous consumption, and I think we see that now with Puff Daddy and Jay-Z. But this kind of casual ostentation that's sort of codified and you have to know what to look for has become a big thing. There's these downtown sneaker stores where kids actually spend all night in line to get limited edition, like Nikes, that there maybe is 300 pair. And these things go on eBay for hundreds and hundreds of dollars. But you have to know what you're looking for. I mean, the average, the uninitiated person would never know that someone is dressed up. So it's kind of this new sort of form of conspicuous consumption for an age where, people like to hide their wealth.
That is where we'll have to leave it. I've been speaking with GQ Magazine's Glenn O'Brien, who writes the Style Guy column and has a book by that name out from Ballantine, and with Paula Baxter, the curator of the Art and Architecture Collection at the New York Public Library, and of the brand new exhibition A Rakish History of Menswear, which is on view at the main branch through April 7th of next year. That, of course, 5th Avenue and 42nd Street. Don't worry about the lions. They won't bother you. Thank you both for joining me.
Thank you.
Thanks for listening to The Brian Lehrer Show from WNYC New York Public Radio. You can hear everything we do and check out our other programs on demand at WNYC.org or on iTunes. This on-demand service is made possible by WNYC and its listeners, so please help support this free service by becoming a member at WNYC.org. And thanks.